Greetings to all readers and contributors of the Journal of Community Safety and Well-Being. Let me begin by thanking the organizers of a recent Toronto event entitled Measuring Collaborative Risk-Driven Intervention for inviting me to speak on this important topic, the role of evidence in the future of collaborative CSWB. I was honored to accept, and in keeping with that honor, I was a little more formal than my usual style in the way I delivered my remarks that evening. And here, I'm going to repeat that delivery in much the same manner for those of you listening to this, our first ever journal podcast. We'd welcome your thoughts on including more of these multimedia variations in future issues of the journal. As many of you may know, I wear a lot of different hats in my professional life. Last year, I was very proud to take on this new and different role as the first editor-in-chief of our peer-reviewed quarterly, the first ever dedicated to our emerging field of collaborative CSWB. It's in that capacity that I deliver this address. So let me begin. January 20th was an historic day. In my view, that day should always be remembered for being the day before January 21st, when almost 3 million women and men took to the streets in cities around the world to push back against the rise of regressive and oppressive rhetoric. Truly, the best thing I've witnessed since the summer of 1969. Two potent words, those, regressive and oppressive. Now, I could get political by concentrating on the latter, but that's not my purpose here, and nor is it the point that I want to address. No, here, in keeping with the focus of the two-day gathering of social innovators, I want to focus on the former. Because of all the dangers we may be sensing in the recent turn of global events, perhaps none is more pernicious than the foreshadowing in that regressive rhetoric, rising here in Canada, in the U.S., and abroad. That foreshadowing of a world where public policy might be formed on the equivalent of a 140-character opinions and ideologies. In many ways, preventing such a trend sits at the very foundation of this event. Among the many signs that were captured and shared over the weekend from that historic day of protest, one really caught my eye. Due to the peculiarities of Facebook, my colleague Cal Corley had liked the photo on his own page. And as a result, as sometimes randomly occurs among Facebook friends, the post appeared on my timeline late that Saturday night. As soon as I read it, I knew I'd have to use it here. The photo showed a young man in his teens, holding a sign that mimicked the usual chant format of protest signs, you know, the ones with which we are all so familiar. It had two questions on the sign and two rejoinders. The sign said, "What do we want?" And the first rejoinder was, "Evidence-based science." Then, of course, "When do we want it?" And the answer was, "After peer review." Now, without a doubt, that's the very definition of academic nerd humor, right? But let's consider its significance to our work together here this week. My good friend Dale McPhee often likes to say that social innovation won't ever matter if it doesn't find its way into public policy. Now, that's a position that might rankle a lot of community-based organizers. And it is true that some of the best social innovation arises outside of the formal systems of government at all levels. In fact, some of the best arises from the grassroots and in counterpoint to those very systems. I have tremendous respect for those innovators who operate in the community space, marshaling philanthropic or fundraised resources, and delivering powerful programs over many years, often with little compensation for themselves. But I've also seen how hard it is for them to sustain those sources of necessary funding year after year, and how too often such innovations remain rooted locally, non-scalable, and unable to reach their full potential in the widest range of environments with similar needs. Let's face it, public policy often equates to those so necessary and sustainable resources. And while not always and certainly not guaranteed, when adopted into public policy, social innovation can become enduring practice, with a much better survival rate in the face of political and ideological swings. Unfortunately, this is so true that we also see the endurance of many practices that have no business being policy in the first place. And that's where we come in. That's why this event is so important. First, Let's take a minute to consider the most direct markets we aim to serve in our social innovation. None of the policing, criminal justice, and human service sectors, whose collaboration we are aiming to achieve in service of CSWB, is without its own sad traditions in the adoption and perpetuation of policies and practices for which there was and is not only no evidence to support them, but ample sources of counter-indicating evidence available to them. From conversion therapies for sexual orientation and gender identity, to extraordinary rendition and enhanced interrogation techniques, from administrative segregation applied to young offenders, to mandatory sentencing and three-strike practices that have led to mass incarceration across the U.S., and from punitive responses to drug and alcohol addiction, to bully-protecting and victim-shaming reassignment policies in classrooms. I could go on and on. Many of these practices derive from long-held social ideologies, some from religious mythologies, and far too many from the mere convenience of the system serving its own administrative lethargy, or from a beleaguered public service that must respond with duplicity to the economic and political priorities of a tax-and-fund system that favors the most advantaged while ever expanding the marginalization of those it was intended to support. More importantly, perhaps, is that we know from experience how fine is the line between opinion and organizational and systemic culture. Consider, just within policing, some of the examples of a culturally based adherence to practices that are not supported by evident social science, or conversely, the steadfast reluctance to adopt practices that are. How many police services continue to deliver DARE, or drug abuse resistance education programs? How often do we hear U.S. and Canadian police spokespersons still invoke the debunked 21-foot rule as the basis for justifying excessive use of lethal force? How often are we asked to simply accept that the documented and disproportionate carding of young African-Canadian males is simply an aberration in the effective application of intelligence-gathering practices, absent the production of any similar documentation on how such intelligence has been applied to any measurable effect? How many police services continue to resist adopting harm reduction practices because they run counter to a punitive narrative? Why is the promise of restorative justice alternatives still being limited to some isolated applications? Now, those were merely some policing and criminal justice questions. Here's one that's for everyone. Why do we continue to let abstract and misinformed privacy concerns be employed as a systemic impediment to sharing the information that is both necessary and legally anticipated in every sector for our human service sectors to respond adequately, collaboratively, and with appropriate urgency in the face of mounting concrete evidence of compound and acutely elevated risk situations, and in the face of multiple inquests that reveal this very habitual practice for its full and ultimate dangers? Now, I recognize we're not here tonight to litigate those or other opinion-based practices, but we must recognize their implications, their lessons, and their costs if we are to continue moving forward in our socially innovative directions in CSWB. Let's consider where we are headed in that journey. Our own private firm completed and published the first Canada-wide account of the hub or situation table adoption 2 months ago. Now, that's just one model, as we all know, but the rate of its proliferation is both impressive and daunting at the same time. To date, the evaluations and data analytics tracking that model have been strong in their own right, but they've also been limited to qualitative studies and formative, developmental, and process-related insights. All good. But we will need much more if we are able to support practitioners who know all too well that, like any socially innovative practice, this is a model that yields a lot of predictable stress points in its early going. We hear a lot about those stressors in our own advisory work, and we talk a lot of adopters off the ledge, so to speak. These stresses may derive from uneven privacy interpretations, or from uneven commitment or energy invested at the table, or in the interventions and follow-through themselves. Whatever their nature, only predictable, consistent, and evidence-informed practices will permit this model, with all its promise, to survive the inevitable reactionary pressures that will most certainly arise from time to time in each and every jurisdiction. It's also worth noting that to date, two particular forms of evidence have yet to appear to any great degree. One of those is what we might call the lived experience outcomes. Our colleague Dr. Nilsson recently published a commentary in the November issue of our journal, and fruitful conversations are well underway in that regard. Enough time has passed that meaningful things, both the positive and negative lessons, can and must be learned from the actual subjects of the 8,500-plus interventions that have occurred across the country. Another form of required study goes to the quantitative and economic impacts of the model. I'm very proud to announce that this March issue of our journal will feature the first comprehensive and quantitative study of this nature. The paper is co-authored as an adaptation of a recent master's thesis by the original researcher, Murray Sawatsky, who retired almost 2 years ago from the Saskatchewan Ministry of Justice, and written jointly with his two research advisors from the University of Regina, Dr. Rick Riddell and Dr. Nick Jones. Murray applied well-established costing models for determining the savings to the city of Prince Albert from measurable reductions in specific categories of crime following the introduction of the first hub model in Canada. He and his collaborators have subsequently and only recently updated his calculations using the costing models that were released just a few weeks ago by Public Safety Canada. Editorial guidelines restrict what I can say about the paper before you read it in this journal. But suffice to say, the calculations, based on policing data alone, reveal significant difference outcomes in most of the crime categories studied, with resulting savings to the Prince Albert Police measured in the millions of dollars over the period from 2011 to 2015. We believe this first study will set the stage for more such studies, as the appetite for economic evidence will continue to grow, not just for that model, but for all collaborative CSWB initiatives and programs. Stepping into my private role for a moment, while conducting our recent nationwide account and in our continuing professional support to many communities, my colleagues and I are increasingly hearing the what comes next question. Now, with a nod to our own global network clients in Durham, Halton, PEI, Brantford, Barrie, North Bay, Brandon, and Surrey, and with respect to the bold initiatives of the OPP, the Ministry of Community Safety and Correctional Services in Ontario, and the Building Partnerships to Reduce Crime team in Saskatchewan, the phrase my colleagues and I have adopted to frame what comes next is CSWB in action. Kind of speaks for itself, right? We have all heard and read a lot about CSWB planning as a general concept, but we look forward to speaking with more and more communities and provinces about how these early adopters are starting to put the action into that concept. And just to be clear, by the word action, I'm referring to defining, pursuing, and implementing the highest priority data-driven and evidence-based opportunities and solutions for systemic reform and collaborative programming that will achieve the measurable CSWB outcomes that communities need most and need most urgently. So to close, let me return to my editor-in-chief role, where on behalf of CSKA, our publisher Multimed, and our team of section editors and professional staff, I'd like to make this commitment and express my promise to you here. Our journal is committed to advancing the social science and thus informing and shaping the public policy that will be necessary to conceiving, launching, proving concept, proliferating, funding, and sustaining progressive and socially innovative practices. Policies and practices that are born of research, evidence, and scientific knowledge where it can be found or created, supported by data where it is or where it can be mined and shared, and at all times anchored in a renewed collaboration among all parts of the public service system to meet the community safety and well-being ambitions and outcomes that all our citizens deserve. If you haven't yet read the journal's first three issues, please do so when you can. Please look forward to reading our March issue, where the interactive dialogue continues, framed by seven very strong and diverse new articles. And let's recognize the importance of sharing with others your work together here at this event and in the collaborations to follow, and all the great work you're all pursuing in your respective day jobs. And so on that, I would ask this of you. Whether you've published many times before, like some of the people in this event have, or if you've never before seen yourself as an author, please join us in this mission. We publish original research, social innovation narratives, practice guidelines, commentaries, editorials, and even letters to the editor. be bold, be controversial. And if you should choose to go with that last category and express your thoughts in writing to the editor-in-chief, please be kind. Thank you.